Welcome to History 101, Lecture 10, The Civilized and the Savages. As I said before, one of the constants in world history, ever since the rise of civilization, is the difficult relation between those who refuse to accept the blessings of civilization, and that means for peasants they have to yield half their harvest to outsiders who do nothing in return for it, and the elites of those civilizations who scorn those outsiders as the barbarians or the savages. There were others. They had a different culture, different religion, but they still had elites. But there were also absolute others who missed the entire plethora of civilization. To the Chinese, the absolute others were the step nomads. To Hindu intellectuals, the other was typically Iran, and the absolute others were typically slash-and-burn cultivations of the hill and forest country, the Nagas or the Pils, the so-called tribals, who are still not fully integrated into Indian society. And to Islamic intellectuals, the others were the Christians or the Hindus, while the absolute others were typically herder and nomadic groups in the frontier lands of southern Islam, such as the nomadic Nuer or the Dinka, who merely deserved to be enslaved. Now, after they had themselves adopted civilization, and sometimes by the very edge of the sword, as in the case of Charlemagne's campaign against the Saxons, that came pretty close to genocide, the former European barbarians still faced what I call others, but for a considerable time they faced, except the Sami or the Lapps of the extreme north, and the very dimly known Arctic Inuit or Eskimos, no absolute others anymore, though in their perception the Irish and the Lithuanians came pretty close. The other of medieval Europe was obviously Islam. On the one hand, that was the inveterate enemy of Christianity that had to be combated at all costs, yet for which Europeans had a certain grudging respect. Because, though they were heathens, the Muslims had a culture that was recognizable, if it was in fact not very close to European culture. Nay, Islamic culture might share most values with it. In the national epic of Spain, El Cantar de mi Cid, from the 11th century, the Moors are described as at the very least heroic adversaries, who exactly act as they should in the medieval code of chivalry. Whereas the word El Cid is actually derived from Arabic Al-Qaid, as the real Rodriguez Díaz de Vivar in the 11th century for a while worked as general for the Emirate of Córdoba, after having faithfully served the King of Castile in the very same position. The Muslims were others, to be sure, but there were others who could be placed within a recognizable hierarchical order. So too were the Turks. They were, as it were, the best enemies of the Europeans. And as the Portuguese then discovered Asia, they similarly encountered others that were, as it were, all recognizable others. Not merely Europe's best enemies, the Muslims, but also the very hierarchical societies of India. Nor, in fact, did the Europeans in Africa, despite all their contempt for Africans, rate the Africans as unrecognizable others. As I said already, the Europeans sat in West Africa by force of contracts they had signed with African chiefs or kings. In other words, the African kings were recognized by the force of these contracts as legitimate agents in international law. And the Europeans later on encountered two, what I'm tempted to call almost Europe's, though not for the same reason, Ethiopia and Japan. These are two critical cases, since contrary to what the vast literature on Europe and its others now tends to argue, Europeans were not always convinced their civilization was superior. Nor were they always driven by racial contempt, nor were they always certain Christians were superior to heathens. For while it is easy to gather dismissive comments about Africans, about Indians, and even about Moors, all Europeans, and here I might well say, without any exception, immediately liked, nay, immediately fell in love with Japan, the place which to them was closest to Europe, surely much closer than Muscovy. For not only were the Japanese clearly white, but Japan had its big cities, its kings, its bureaucrats, and above all, it had its recognizable nobility, all with knights, castles, and so on. Though clearly, as yet, lacking Christianity, the whole place so uncannily recalled home, that Japan, really, throughout the modern period, posed a question. And a question that has more contributed to the cultural relativism of the Enlightenment than most writers are willing to acknowledge. And that Italian writer Fosco Marani, in the 20th century, brilliantly put, Japan was a shock. It was a civilized country that had reached maturity and splendor amongst other paths, owing nothing to the spiritual forces that had become fetishes in the West, classical learning or the Reformation. Here were examples of moral coherence, of righteousness, of spiritual maturity, more numerous and more striking than anywhere else. And then the question appears, does Christianity include history, or does history include Christianity? And the answer is obvious. Civilization may flourish by many stems. Merely man and the mystery surrounding him are final. All religions, all philosophies, are attempts to bridge the chasm between the world of consciousness and the challenge of existence. No one has the key. And Japan was already a shock in the 16th century. The general tone of virtually all accounts of Japan from the early modern period tends thus to be very positive, whereas in most other accounts of most other places, even such clearly civilized ones as India, there is always an undertone of, yes, but they are inferior to us. If it comes to Japan, the tone is rather that the Japanese were different, but not inferior. Of course, all this was somewhat tinged by the hope of the earliest witnesses on Japan, the Jesuits, that the Japanese might be converted. But even after they had been violently expelled from the country, others, and more secular witnesses, such as the German doctor Engelbert Kämpfer, gave a highly positive account of the country. While he found little to admire in Muscovy, to him a place full of churches, with nobody attending them, and lots of loose women, but no brothels, if it came to Japan, it's all praise. On the main Tokyo, Osaka, highway, Kämpfer noted, for example, that there were even convenient private toilets at regular distances, something completely unimaginable in Europe then, and in fact commonly now. And he even used the case of Japan to snipe at abuses in Europe, such as those idiotic witch trials, the judges of which he condemned as greedy, evil people. His father, after all, had made a living by administering the last sacraments to supposed witches. When it comes to Ethiopia, there was often a deep contempt for the primitive way of living of the Ethiopians. Yet Ethiopia was a different shock and a different challenge. Few could withhold a certain admiration for the Ethiopian Coptic Church, which had legitimate claims to be a legitimate branch of Christianity, as ancient as Catholicism, yet one which has evolved in an entirely different matter. Was Christianity a matter of piety, or was it one of ritual? And could the Ethiopians be seen as heretics if they had been out of contact with Rome for more than 1,000 years? The Portuguese and Italian Jesuit missionaries to Ethiopia finally settled on the view that they were not heretics, and surely no savages. And though the Ethiopians were obviously black, any disparaging comment on race are notoriously absent from writings on Ethiopia. Their view was that, over time, certain abuses had crept into the church. The missionaries, however, were somewhat divided on the question whether it sufficed to have Ethiopia acknowledge the authority of Rome, or whether these abuses had to be rooted out root and branch. Nonetheless, they assiduously tried to combat those abuses in the meantime. And that so much enraged the Amhari clergy that they finally had to be expelled from Ethiopia in 1638. Yet, next to those recognizable others, the Islamic best enemy, Japan, or the non-Western Christians, there was also a different kind of others, whom the lawyer, José da Costa, in 1600 divided in two different groups. There were others who had no writing, but cities, governments, law, and some recognizable form of religion. The non-Islamic West African kingdoms were in that category. So was Mweni Mutapa, so was the Kingdom of Angola, so were the Aztecs, and so were the Incas. In order to receive the gospel, this second group of others could be put under the rule of a Christian ruler, but they were not to be deprived of their property or expelled from their land. Thus, to quote a non-American example, in the early 17th century, the Portuguese had acquired vast swathes of land in Mozambique from the Mweni Mutapa. But they always stuck to at least legal fiction that that land had all been bought from the Mweni Mutapa, and that the property of that land was ultimately vested in the Mweni Mutapa Emperor too, whereas the Portuguese were absolutely not allowed to throw people living on their estates off their land. In East Africa, the absolute others were herdsmen, such as the Kuyu or the Maasai. For there was yet a third group who had no recognizable centralized government, no kings, and no clearly recognizable priesthood either. Beyond the Americas, this included the Khoisan, or Hottentots, of South Africa, who, as primitives, the Dutch already in the 17th century began to conceive as a kind of plague that should be exterminated. In the Americas, all North American Indian societies were in that category, for they were egalitarian ones. They lacked kings, they lacked nobles. Thus, for instance, the Cherokee were described by the English in the 18th century as a very odd people. There is no law or subjection amongst them, and the very lowest of them think of themselves as high or as great as the rest. The European elites classed them as barbaric, and because they typically conducted slash-and-burn cultivation, they had no recognizable sense of property, which means that you sit on the same plot of land for centuries, either. Private buying or selling of land did not take place among North American Indians. Land was always owned by the group. Since these people had no sense of private property, they had therefore failed to create an effective dominion in legalese over their land, nor had they some recognizable authority to whom the final right to dispose of their land belonged, such as the Mutapa. After all, they sat on their land for a while, and then they voluntarily abandoned it again. These people were therefore mere wandering gangs of savages who lived in a most brutish manner, as the legal scholar Thomas Hobbes put it. They were therefore not legitimate agents in international law either. Their lands were therefore, in a legal sense, empty lands. And according to Roman law, a thing, a piece of land, or a creature which does not belong to anybody becomes your property if you are the first to use it. Furthermore, as these people were not formally recognized agents in international law, European states were entitled to proclaim sovereignty over them. This was not the same as ownership. That had to be separately obtained and bought. The best known case probably being the purchase of Manhattan Islands by the Dutch from the Delaware Indians for 60 guilders, or 2 day salaries, in 626. It did mean, however, that the English, French, Spanish, Dutch or Portuguese government, once it had planted a settlement or solemnly hoisted the flag, obtained the right to rule over the native inhabitants that they had obtained by right of either discovering their lands or by treaties with other European states. Thus, for instance, the boundaries the English crown fixed by force of treaties with the Dutch Republic in 1663 included large groups of Indians in both New York and the Suriname, who had never agreed to be included in that treaty at all, and had in fact not even been consulted. Yet they were henceforth effectively deemed subjects of the British crown, or for that matter the Arawak Indians of Suriname became subjects of the Dutch Republic. Now, European regulations for the conduct of war and the Christian doctrine of just war exclusively applied to war between countries, but not to war within a country. Countries had the authority to act against rebels as they saw fit, including savage reprisals that were not permitted in international law. After all, peasant uprisings in Europe were commonly followed by scores of hangings, breaking bodies on the wheels, and so on and so forth. Thus, for example, by the force of treaties between European states, the Wampanoag leader Metacom was deemed a rebel when he revolted against the English in 1675, and was therefore subject to savage retaliation. His head was afterwards paraded on a pike through all the towns of New England. Whereas, if this would have been a normal interstate war, the two commanders would have cordially exchanged swords, have toasted each other's health, and the losing party would then be allowed to peacefully retreat to his estates. On the other hand, a rebel in Europe would have been treated in exactly the same way as Metacom was too. Now, this legal frame was more or less shared by the Europeans. But, nonetheless, there were major differences between them, and they both relate to the kind of church they had as to the kind of law they used. In both Spanish and Portuguese law, Indians, if they had voluntarily submitted to the king, became vasallos del rey, vassals of the king, who had in feudal law duties to the king, but had rights too. The official line the Portuguese crown followed was that the Indians were to gather in settlements where they had to be instructed in the faith and in civilized manners. They could not refuse to settle there, for in that case, refusing to obey their sovereign, they became rebels, and in that case, they could be enslaved as well. However, if they would gather in these settlements, they would be granted equality in front of the law, and they would be allowed a legal entitlement to land to be used for their own subsistence. It was a system that worked reasonably well in the 16th century, but it began to run into ever more difficulties later on, as it encountered ever more resistance by Portuguese settlers, who used the Indians at best as serfs, more commonly as slaves, and who constantly raided the Indian settlements to obtain more slaves. For the Spaniards, by 1540, the conquista of the Americas began to run more or less out of steam. For after the great windfalls of the conquest of Peru and Mexico, there was increasingly little to gain elsewhere. Because scouting for the legendary El Dorado, Hernández Soto in 1537 got a charter of the crown to discover all the lands of Florida and anything beyond that, and to claim all that land for the Spanish crown. Yet his great expedition to reconnoitre North America from 1539 to 1542 discovered little worth conquering. There was no gold or silver there, and there were no big cities there either. Merely hordes of hostile and dirt-poor Pueblo Indians whom de Soto had to fight on any occasion. And to the north of that lay the barren American prairies.
were Spanish counting expeditions, both famished and thirsted, and which were only populated by nomadic tribes, whose only wealth appeared to be dogs. Similarly, Francisco de Orellana's attempt to locate the land of cinnamon and gold the Peruvian Indians were talking about, of what the Spanish then called the river Rio Grande, where on one occasion he had to fight an Indian army, mostly consisting of women, who Orellana compared to the mythical Greek women warriors, or Amazonas, and that name stuck to the river, was a virtually unspeakable tale of misery and hunger, and above all, of both hostile and, in the Spanish perception, the poor Indians. Furthermore, there was not only nothing to gain there at all, but while the Spaniards had not much difficulty subduing settled agricultural populations, who were tied to their plots of land and could not disappear, they had massive problems subduing either groups engaged in Sweden cultivation, or groups partly subsisting on hunting, and above all, they had difficulties subduing traditional hunter-gatherers groups. These groups were not only completely elusive, but they had little the Spaniards could take from them. Thus, for example, the Aymara of southern Chile managed to utterly defeat the Spaniards in 1598. The Spanish garrisons there had actually to surrender to the Aymara, after which the Spanish crown closed a formal treaty with them. It would not expand its possessions beyond the Biobío River, 200 kilometers south of Santiago de Chile. It would prohibit any further settlements there and recognize them henceforth as formally independent. Again, in northern Mexico, Spanish haciendas and mission posts ran into the formidable Apache nation, who after the adoption of horses from the Spanish in the 17th century became an ever more formidable force. As with the mobility the horses gave them, they could strike without warning, and the Spaniards were unable to trace Apache bands. One Spanish chronicle described the Apache in the 18th century as, quote, a fiery and bellicose people, very crafty in war. They do not dwell in settlements, but they dwell in tents and huts, for they move around, seeking game, which is all their sustenance. They occupy vast expanses of country, and they are so warlike, all of them, that fighting them has been the crucible of courage for the Spaniards. The Apache lived from hunting what the Spaniards called their cows, or of course the North American buffalo, salting the meat and exchanging hides for foodstuffs to a growing population. With the Apaches, Spanish settlements and Spanish missions ran pretty much into a solid wall. They had no interest in converting, and the Spaniards might hunt their bands down, but they were utterly unable to subjugate them. Again, in Texas, the Spanish missionaries and colonists were immediately within range of the redoubtable Comanche, who arrived from the Great Plains at the turn of the 18th century, a most warlike people, Spaniards bewailed, who above all liked to destroy churches and altars, and whom the Spaniards combated with as little success as the Apache. The local governor there was finally instructed by the Viceroy of Mexico to permit all their insolent familiarities and to find tobacco for them so that we may smoke, for of course negotiations amongst North American Indians were traditionally affirmed by smoking the peace pipe. The only way the Comanche could really be removed was by basically killing all the buffaloes they relied on for food, but that only became possible with the rapid firing rifles of the 19th century. Thus the Spanish conquests, by 1560, more or less settled within a mutual recognized border. On one side of that border, there were the, what the Spaniards called, Indios de Paz, and on the other side, there were the Indios de Guerra, or Indios Bárbaros. Those were beyond the pale of Christian civilization. The best way to think of the Spanish conquests in 1600 is like a kind of patchwork. with a few densely controlled areas, the viceroyalties of Peru and Mexico, and then Spanish control gradually petered out on the fringes of the viceroyalties. Those fringes, for that matter, included the very umbilical cord of the Spanish Empire itself, the Panama Isthmus, that continued to be controlled by hostile Indians into the 18th century. As Panama was thus not really claimed by anybody, this prompted the Scots in 1690 to attempt establishing a settlement there, the Darien settlement, that proved to be an utter disaster and loaded Scotland with so much debt to England that it has been claimed the Darien failure was a major cause for the Act of the Union, for uniting with England at least cleared all the Darien debt. Again, unclaimed territory included swamps of coastal Guatemala, the coast of which was populated by a fierce Maya population that was never quite subdued by the Spaniards, and amongst whom, by the 1670s, buccaneers from Jamaica began to establish camps for looking wood, and who in due course began to mix with the buccaneers, for the buccaneers had few racial prejudices. The English crown was very much embarrassed with that entire wild settlement in the very middle of Spanish territory, and thus it only sent an official representative there in 1783, and the territory was finally proclaimed to the crown colony of British Honduras, present Belize. For that unclaimed territory, beyond the pale of civilization, the Spanish crown grasped the two different systems. If the Indians were utterly hopeless and held out no or few hopes of civilizing them, such as was the case for the Comanche or the Apache, it used a system of presidios, small military outposts paid by the Spanish treasury, who had to control the area. Mostly, the soldiers were convicted criminals. They were violent men, obviously, and it's small wonder the Apache retaliated to them violently too. They spared neither Spanish prisoners nor Spanish women. Thus too, there wasn't a lot of animo for settling there, and the Spanish presence thus gradually petered out in northern Mexico, until the early 18th century, when, worried about a possible French advance into Texas, the crown stationed a small garrison at San Antonio. Yet if the Indians held out some hope they might be civilized, such as the Guarani Indians of Paraguay, a densely settled farming population, who lived astride the critical Paraná River, that, as I said in a previous lecture, led straight to Potosí, or the Indians of California, who were admittedly hunter-gatherers, but did not move around, but rather lived in villages, as the proverbial fertility of California allowed for a far denser population, and they were thus deemed better than the Comanche or the Apache, in that case, the Spanish crown grasped the missionaries. Aside from which, the Spanish crown, in the late 18th century, began to dread both English and Russian fur traders, who were coming from Alaska, so that it had occupied California before either the Russians or the English were able to. These missionaries, to both Paraguay and California, were by and large well-meaning, devoted men. Their attitudes towards the Indians ranged from genuine, if paternalistic affection, to wrathful disgust. They were ill-equipped, nor did most of them truly desire, to understand complex and radically different Native American customs. Using European standards, they condemned the Indians as the absolute others. They lived in the wilderness. They worshipped false gods, or no god at all. They had no written laws, they had no standing armies, and they had no churches, in the case of California. Or in Paraguay, as it was said at the time, they knew neither king nor lord, nor any known law, nor any fixed rules for the administration of government. Instead, the Guarani shamefully thought of themselves as absolutely free, and they lived absolutely independent. To thus teach them the civilized system of laws, king and lordships, and indeed, in the Guarani Californian view, to teach them unfreedom, they grasped to a system called reducciones, fixed settlements with the purpose of totally assimilating the indigenous populations into the European culture and the Catholic religion. Indians were congregated around mission stations through the use of various means, including forced settlement, whereupon they were to be reduced from the perceived undisciplined state and converted into civilized members of colonial society. The Indians were initially attracted into the mission compounds by gifts of goods, of food, colored beads, bits of bright cloth, or trinkets. Once a Native American Gentile was then baptized, they were labeled a neophyte, a new believer. This happened only after a brief period, during which the initiates were instructed in the most basic aspects of the Catholic faith. Before many natives were lured to join the mission stations out of curiosity and out of a sincere desire to participate and engage in trade, many found themselves trapped once they were baptized. The neophytes were kept in well-guarded mission compounds, and the policy of the missionaries was to keep them constantly occupied. In order to teach them the Christian doctrine, by the sweat of your brow, you will eat your food. Whereas the Indians so far, in the Spanish perception, merely spent all their time idling, or in even more disgraceful pursuits of the flesh. The women in the relaciones were committed to dressmaking, knitting, weaving, embroidering, laundering and cooking, while some of the stronger girls would count floor or carry the dope bricks to the men engaged in building. The men worked in a variety of jobs, having learned from the missionaries how to plow, how to sow, how to irrigate, cultivate, reap, thresh and clean. In addition, they were taught to build adobe houses, tan leather hides, shear sheep, weave rugs, making soap, paint and other useful. The call of the mission was, above all, to become self-sufficient in relatively short time. Farming, therefore, was the most important industry of any mission. Barley, maize and wheat were amongst the most commonly grown crops. Cereal grains were dried and ground by stone into flour. The labor organization of a mission resembled a slave plantation in many respects. Foreigners who visited the missions remarked at how the priests' control over the Indians appeared excessive, but it was probably necessary, given the white man's isolation and numeric disadvantage. Though it is perhaps easy, certainly for contemporary European listeners, to condemn those missionaries as religious bigots, it should be stressed they had the very best intentions. But the big problem they had, without them of course ever realizing it, was that by gathering so many people in a single place, they also made them particularly susceptible to epidemics. Thus, often more than half the Indians gathered on the mission stations would die within a few years. The reducciones doubtless had their flaws. Nonetheless, they did serve to protect the Indians against depredations of both European slave traders in Paraguay and European settlers encroaching upon their land in California. As California was acquired by the USA, the Indian population was simply completely pushed aside by European immigrants. It dropped from 1 million around 1800 to less than 20,000 by 1860. For, as the Americans began to come into California, they simply died like flies. The first factor was the food supply, Shelburne Cook sums it up. The second factor was disease. And the third factor, which strongly intensified the effect of the other two, was the social and physical disruption visited upon the Indian. He was driven from his home by the thousands. He was starved, he was beaten, he was raped, and he was murdered with impunity. He was not only given no assistance in the struggle against foreign diseases, but he was prevented from even adopting the most elementary measures to secure his food, clothing, and shelter. The utter devastation caused by the coming of the white man was literally incredible. in Paraguay, the missions were dissolved in 1764, after the Spanish crown had dissolved the Jesuit order, and that the Jesuits were accused of having made the Indians to slaves and having enriched themselves at the cost of the Indians. And subsequently, the Reducciones were abolished. And then, to quote the classic English history of the Paraguay mission, the fast estancias, in which, at the expulsion, more than 1 million head of cattle pastured, became but bare plains, in which the cattle that were left had all run wild or perished from neglect. Wild beasts roamed the outskirts of the half-deserted towns. Dense scrub invaded the pasture lands, and in the erstwhile cultivated fields, rank weeds sprang up that choked the crops. The churches were unserved, and in the evening air no more hymns resounded. Nor did the long, white-robed processions, headed by a cross, pass to the fields to peaceful labor, marshaled by the priests. And the Indian population almost disappeared. The Guarani, collected from the woods with so much effort to the missionaries, had shrunk away before the baneful breath of unaccustomed contact with whites. And so the self-created coddles of progress left their lands barren, and it awaited a time when factories would pollute the sky and render miserable European immigrants, who, fleeing from their slavery at home, would have found it waiting for them in their new paradise beyond the seas. And yet, despite all that, the missions have still served to preserve the Guarani population, so that Paraguay is now the only country in the southern cone of the Americas that by and large speaks an Indian language, Guarani, together with Spanish, the official language of Paraguay. In sum then, the Spaniards in general chose a practice of various forms of accommodations with the wild or barbarian Indians. Let's turn to the English. Thomas Morton arrived at Plymouth almost immediately after the Quakers had set up their heavenly city on a hill, and he set up a thriving business there in furs. He tried to win both the hearts and the minds of his Indian business partners by going hunting with them or going swimming with them. He built his own house, where ale was served and where profane singing was heard on Sundays, so that he was ostracized and banished from the holy city of the Puritans in 1638. And after he had become bankrupt in England, shaken by a civil war, he ended his life as a tramp in Boston. Morton was thus actually one of the few people who knew the founded savages. And Morton wrote about their lives. Quote, "I cannot deny that a civilized nation has the preeminence of an uncivilized, by means of those instruments that are found to be common amongst civil people, and that the uncivil want to use thereof, to make themselves masters of those ornaments that make such a glorious show. Now, since it is but food and clothing that men need, why should not the natives of New England be said to live richly, having no want of either? More clothes are just the beds of fame, and the variety of fashions is but the greater abuse of the creature. The beasts of the forests serve to furnish the Indians at all times with what they please. Fish and flesh they have in great abundance, which they both roast and boil. And I much need to commend them in this particular, that though they buy many commodities of our nation, yet they keep but few, and those are of special use. For they love not being encumbered with many utensils, and although every proprietor knows his own, yet all things, so long as they last, are used in common amongst them. According to human reason, guided only by the light of nature, these people lead happy and free lives. for they lead a life void of care, that care which torments the minds of so many Christians. They do not delight in baubles, but they care about useful things. So their life is so void of care, and they are so loving with one another, that they make use of those things they enjoy, the wife accepted, as common goods. And they are therein so compassionate that, rather than that one would starve through want, they would rather starve old. Thus do they pass away the time merrily, not regarding our pomp, which they see daily before their faces, but better content with their own, which some of us esteem so menial. They may rather be considered to live richly, wanting nothing that is needful, and they are to be commended for leading a contented life. Now it was obviously not at all an ideal. In particular, the American Indians bitterly fought one another. And yet, it was a life even many captives deemed superior to that of a day laborer in England. But the white man, said Sioux Chief Standing Bull, never grasps the Indian for the same reason he does not understand America. The roots of his tree of life have not really grasped the rock and the soil, and therefore the white man is always troubled by fear. Rather, the English, as ethnobotanist Melvin Gilmore sums it up, never really sought to make friends of the native population, nor to make adequate use of the plants or the animals of the continent. Rather, they wanted to exterminate everything they found, and to supplant it with plants, animals, and inhabitants they found useful at home. Now there were a couple of things about particularly New England that made it completely different from any other colonial venture in the New World, and that indeed made the British in North America throughout distinct from the Spanish or the Portuguese, and this particularly so when it came to their politics as regards the Native Americans. Admittedly, here too, there was a degree of mutual accommodation, and there was cohabitation, for the life of the trappers and of the fur traders on the North American frontier was not really that different from the Indians, and they commonly inhabited with Indian women as well. And yet the fur traders were not the thrust of English colonization. They were, as it were, its freebooting edge, just like the buccaneers of Belize were also. Though, unlike them, they were followed by surveyors who were to measure the land for it to be sold to colonists. The first of the differences with the Spaniards was that English colonization was not led by minor nobles who had grown upon such chivalric novels as Amadis de Gaul, as rather by Puritans or Quakers, and they had particularly grown up on the Old Testament. And the Old Testament, of course, says that God's chosen people had been given the land of Israel, a land that had to clear of heathen Philistines. So too, the Puritans perceived themselves as God's chosen people, who were similarly commanded to take control of a land of milk and honey, to properly prepare for the Day of Judgment. That was to the Puritans imminent any moment. And so, if need be, they had to exterminate its original inhabitants. They, after all, were not merely heathens, like the Philistines, but incorrigible heathens, for they had all heard the Indians were a savage people, cruel, barbarous, treacherous. So as the New England Indians were struck by a renewed epidemic in 1616, for previous diseases had already more than half the Indian population in the 16th century, and one thing which attracted both the Dutch and the English to North America was that the place looked like a rather neglected garden, of course, since most of its gardeners had died. With that renewed epidemic, the Indians died in such numbers that whole villages were strewn with nothing but dead carcasses. And then, Puritan preacher John Winthrop could write happily, the Indians had all died of the smallpox, so the Lord has cleared our title to what we possess. The Spanish monarchy had as early as 1515, on repeating promptings thereto by the Vatican, proclaimed that the only justification of its self-proclaimed dominion over most of the Western Hemisphere could be, and should be, that it converted the natives to Christianity. However, the English monarchy, let alone the Puritans, did not give a lot of thought about that. The Puritans, bluntly put, were interested in saving their own souls. They didn't care much for those of the Indians. Now, admittedly, this was certainly not true for all the other founders of British North America. William Penn, who in 1681 obtained a concession to a huge tract of territory of King Charles to serve for a Quaker settlement that he first wanted to call New Wales, but the king persuaded him to name after his father, Admiral William Penn, Penn's Woodland of Pennsylvania, and its new capital he named the City of Brotherly Love of Philadelphia. William Penn insisted that any tract of territory there was to be decently bought from the Indians. The Indians were to be equally treated in court as the Englishmen, and the only justification to acquiring their territory would be converting them. So that the Quakers, unlike the Puritans, made a considerable effort to converting Indians. Yet the Indians were not that interested in converting, because basically both the Puritans and the Quakers thought that before converting, the Indians had first to be taught civil life. That is, they had to toil day to night, they had to have as many useless household utensils as possible, they had to live in proper, civilized houses without any isolation, unlike Indian longhouses, and with a fireplace. So in that kind of houses, everything was freezingly cold, and you could sit the whole day in winter inhaling smoke from the fireplace. Or again, both insisted that they should wear the heavy, uncomfortable woolen clothes they wore. Only then could they be considered true Christians. Small wonder Indians hesitated to convert. Second, completely unlike the Reducciones, that in a way reproduced a European pattern recalling the early Middle Ages, the English expansion was capitalist throughout. The Puritan settlement accepted, it was after all put up as commercial ventures, granted charters by the Crown. The Massachusetts Bay Company that founded the city of Boston in 1628, the Virginia Company that in 1607 established its Jamestown settlement in what is now Virginia, in Powhatan territory, or even Cecil Calvert, Lord Baltimore's proprietary settlement of Maryland, the capital of which was named after him. All these were throughout commercial enterprises, put up for cultivating tobacco, in either case with indentured labor, as the Caribbean became reserved for sugar only. And indeed, most former indentured laborers from Barbados moved to Maryland and Virginia later on, as all their former land was being cleared for the sugar plantations. Part of the investment in those companies came from London and Plymouth merchants. But it came above all from that very same gentry clearing the peasants of their lands to make way for sheep, so that not only did they have a lot of money to invest, but there were plenty of dispossessed people around in England who were willing to emigrate. Now, I should immediately say, there is a whole literature seeking to deny this. They argue that freedom of consciousness was the main reason to emigrate. And yet it is still striking that while the English were willing to migrate in droves to North America, one reason why the Dutch settlement of New Amsterdam wasn't much of a success was that the Dutch weren't willing to emigrate. Thus New Amsterdam, with only 6,000 people, came to be hemmed in all around by 1660 by English settlements that already sported more than 250,000 inhabitants. And the Dutch would have had little choice but abandoning it later on anyway. This was not only since the Netherlands was then by itself an immigrant country, but especially as it was dominated by prosperous tenant farmers, always short of hands, so that the Netherlands did not feature a similar rural exodus as England in that period. Now third, while all these companies shared with the Caribbean the idea that they were set up to make a profit and to cultivate a single crop not available in the motherland, what they did not intend to do. Unlike the Dutch West Indian Company and the French West India Company, that in 1608 founded the settlement of Quebec, and finally with the English Hudson Bay Company, that owned much of present Canada until the middle of the 19th century, was to establish merchant settlements, confined to a small, fortified settlement, and limited to exchanging alcohol, iron implements, firearms, though that was officially prohibited, textiles or trinkets, with the Indians in exchange for furs. It was, bluntly put, in the best interest of such companies to keep Indians alive. Thus, for example, the governor of New Amsterdam, William Kieft, was removed for having started the war with the Lenape Indians. Not because of the atrocities during that war, and there were worse enough. The practice of taking scalps originated from that war, but because it had ruined the fur trade. Similarly, the only area where the Indians were never dispossessed on a vast scale were those of the Hudson Bay Company, for the Hudson Bay Company was interested in trade and not in settlement. To the Virginia Company, however, just like was the case in the Caribbean, the Indians had to be removed, first to make way for indentured laborers, and then, as Virginia began to turn to the cultivation of African rice for export to the Caribbean, where every inch of available ground had to be reserved for sugar, slaves. Incidentally, and sadly, one of the reasons why the English, and then even the United States, tended to be very forgiving to the Creek and the Cherokee, and constantly promised them they would be left in possession of all their native lands, was that they were so useful for tracing down and hunting down fugitive slaves. However, Virginia, Maryland, Carolina were still not the Caribbean, and New England was even less so. Nor, of course, was New York. Rice was only demanded in the Caribbean, as was the fish caught off the shores of Maine and Long Island, and above all the rum that was distilled in New England and New York. Rum was, besides being consumed in the Caribbean, also a lubricant of the slave trade, and the rum refineries established by the 1660s on are really at the root of the industrialization of North America. There was tobacco too, but that boat brought only small profits in England. What did, however, flourish was the cultivation of maize, and of corn, as the Americans call it, and the wood trade, though in the 17th century that wood was still too expensive to fetch it all the way from North America to England. And since both the Crown and the English gentry capitalists, or for that matter the London or Bristol merchants, were at a loss what better use to make of those colonies, they gradually became lands of tenant farmers, except upstate New York, dominated by manors that the Dutch had introduced there. Those tenant farmers cultivated freehold lands for a small quit rent. Colonial America was thus almost exclusively rural. In 1800, 95% of its population lived either on the land or in towns with less than 10,000 inhabitants, and it had lots of space. Whereas England had more than 100 people per square miles, the USA in that period had less than 9. And so, argued Marquis de Crèvecoeur in Letters from an American Farmer, one of the first works to exalt a new man taking slave in America in the late 18th century, the instant I enter my own land, the bright idea of property, of exclusive right, of independence, exalts my mind. Precious soil, I say to myself. By what singular custom of law is it that thou wast made the riches of the freeholder? What should we, American farmers, be without a distinct possession of that soil? It feeds us. It clothes us. From it we draw an ever greater exuberancy. Our best meat, our richest drink, the very honey of our bees, comes from this privileged spot. No wonder we should thus cherish its possession. No wonder that so many Europeans, who have never been able to say that a portion of land was theirs, crossed the Atlantic to realize that happiness. and it made North America entirely different from Mexico, let alone Peru, to which people emigrated to become missionaries, merchants, or landlords, but surely not to become tenant farmers. Now fourth, in this rurality, staggeringly, Europeans almost immediately forgot the European demographic pattern that had been drilled into them for 300 years. And that, as we can see in this case, was primarily a response to the limited availability of land after the medieval phase of expansion. And that particularly applied to the ones whom we should perhaps least expect it from, given their notorious brutality, though the average American TV preacher, indeed the American Bible Belt, still commonly sports huge families. So the Puritans immediately forgot the European demographic pattern. In New England, people married at 16 for women, 18 for men, they had children yearly, and they lived far longer than people in Europe did too, and they died less frequently than Europeans in addition. Indeed, Americans were taller than Europeans too, all of which suggests that white colonial North America was by the late 17th century one of the richest, perhaps the richest place on earth. As a consequence, the population simply exploded. The southern colonies expanded from 1,000 to 100,000 people in a century. New England grew from 4,000 to 85,000, while New England actually received few immigrants and was losing people to other colonies. As this population not only exploded, but everybody wanted his own farm, and preferably as far away from his neighbors as possible, the true big business in North American colonies became land speculation. As one Puritan had already remarked in the 1670s, land will become for us, English, as great a god as gold is for the Spaniards. That land was first measured, then divided into a standard grid pattern, and then titles to land were sold to investment companies, first mainly in London, and then increasingly in the colonies as well. To quote one of these 18th century Donald Trumps, "Anybody who neglects all the present opportunities for hunting down good land and marking it as his own will never regain it." He was called George Washington, and Washington was furious when the British Crown in 1763 barred any settlement of Englishmen across the Appalachian Mountains, in which Washington had invested all his good money. Because of solemn covenants, the British Crown had administered with the Indians that their title to the land would be respected forever. However, Washington had hoped it would merely prove a temporary expedient to appease them, as it would indeed prove to be, but that was merely after the American Revolution. For to the Indians, the seizure of power by the settlers, with the proclamation of the USA, was universally bad news. The settlers were both intent on seizing their land and on evicting them. And while slaves were deemed 3/4 citizens of the USA by the Constitution of the USA, Indians were not subjects of the United States. Instead, they were seen, ruled the Supreme Court, as domestic dependent nations over whom the federal government had plenary and legalese power. That is, subject to approval of Congress, the President of the USA could dispose over them as he saw fit, including dispossessing them. And the precondition of all that development of the white settlements was obviously that the Indians were to be cleared of their land that was now to be used for useful purposes. Though the squatters or the speculators saw this not as a land grab, but rather as a part of God's larger plan for humanity. Now that the Indians were rapidly becoming a minority in their own land would by itself have sufficed to alienate them. But additionally to all that, the English settlers brought with them rapidly multiplying numbers of pigs and cattle that damaged the Indian field. They damaged the Indian ecology by draining wetlands or by building fences. And above all, they began to burn or cut down forests on which the Indian slash and burn cultivation depended. Thus, Sachem Mianomoto of the Mohicans told the other tribes, or as they are called in Native American studies, the nations, already in 1634, "We Indians must now all be brothers to each other. We must be as one. Otherwise we shall all be consumed. For you know our fathers had plenty of deer, and skins, and turkeys, and our coves are full of fish and fowl. But now the English have gotten their land. They cut down the grass with their scythes, and with their axes they fell the trees. Their cows and their horses eat the grass. Their hawks spoil our clam banks. Soon we all be starved. However, the problem was that on the one hand, the Indians were very seldomly united. Not only as they were riven by centuries-old animosities between the nations, and there was a lot of ill feeling between them, because it was common to use captive for wars to do the most taxing manual labor in the Indian communities, but also as the various Europeans, Swedes, Dutch, French, and English, all started delivering increasing amounts of firearms to the Indians in exchange for beaver furs, or in return for adding them against other Europeans. It was a somewhat similar situation as in West Africa in the same period, where, if you did not prey on your neighbor would prey on you. Thus, some nations initially mightily profited from the coming of the Europeans, the Mohawks in England, and especially the Iroquois of upstate New York. They were armed by the English and the French in turn, and were in the course of the 17th century able to conquer a vast territory stretching from New York up to the territory of the Illinois in the so-called Beaver Wars, illustrated in the picture to this lecture. And Iroquois raiding parties reached as far away as the territories of the Miamis in South Michigan or on to Lake Superior in the north. In other words, when a group of Indians prepared to resist the English encroachments on their land, there was always another group prepared to fight with the English against them. The Narragansetts and the Mohicans were well prepared to help the Puritans in their war against the Pequot in 1638. The Mohicans, in turn, were ready to fight the Narragansetts and the Wampanoag during Metacom on King Philip's War in 1675. On the other hand, the Indians also increasingly needed the English. For as Chief Pontiac, or really Obawaniak, told the assembled nations, "Why do you suffer the white men to dwell amongst you? My children, you have forgotten customs and traditions of your forefathers. Why do you not clothe yourself in skins, as they did? Use the bow and arrow, and the stone-pointed lances which they used. You have bought guns, knives, kettles, and blankets from the white men, until you can no longer do without them. And what is worse, you have drunk the poisonous fire water, which turns you into fools. Fling these things away. Live as your wise forefathers lived before you." But that obviously meant stepping backwards into the Stone Age, and very few Indians were really willing to do so. The Indians might detest the pale faces, but they needed them too. In other words, when the Indians were still in sufficient numbers in the 17th century to drive the white invaders out, they were really too divided to ever do so. And the Indians needed them as trading partners as well. By the 18th century, the whites' numbers had increased so much that they stood no chance against them anymore, though they tried exploiting divisions amongst the whites as much as possible. In the 17th and 18th century, the Indian nations fought a large number of big and small conflicts with the settlers. In such conflicts, they had an obvious advantage, as they knew the terrain better than the white invaders, and they could sneak up to white settlements undetected and attack unwary colonists. Yet if they had to fight large forces of the whites, they were invariably outgunned, outnumbered, and slaughtered. Those Indian wars were very nasty wars on both sides. The Indians spared women or children, and they tortured their victims by, for example, every day slicing pieces of flesh from their bodies. And particularly, since the Indians could suddenly emerge and then disappear again, everywhere and anywhere, this caused a general atmosphere of fear amongst the colonists. So the colonial armies and militias were under pressure of wives and children to retaliate with utmost cruelty against the Indians. During one incident, during King Philip's War for example, the colonial militia ran wild. They burned 600 people alive in their huts. But since everybody was afraid the Indians might suddenly re-emerge again, to clear the Indian vermin, they had to be cleared away entirely, far away from any white settlement. So that, quote, hunting Indians became a popular sport in New England. Especially since the prisoners, commonly sold as slaves to the Caribbean, were worth good money, and the risk was slight anyway. End quote. The survivors were killed or sold as slaves. Women, particularly beautiful ones, fetching particularly good prices, were sold away. Indeed, raping squaws remained a popular pastime on the American frontier right into the 20th century. And again indeed, though genealogical TV programs from the USA, such as These Are Your Ancestors, always trace impeccably European genealogies for present US citizens, there may be a lot more Indian blood amongst them than they're ever willing to admit. So many Indians were finally killed, related cotton mather contently, that traversing the woods, it is no unusual thing to find dead Indians all around, there being literally nobody to bury them anymore. By 1700, there were hardly any Indians left in New England. Merely some defeated and scattered people were left, whom Mather cherished crony bands of Pecans, and whose inaccessible hideouts in the forest were now mere kennels, Mather wrote with great satisfaction. The Indians had been taught a lesson, and their land could now be used for useful things, rather than being wasted by wandering tribes of savages. The Abenaki Nation had, before the coming of the English, consisted of 12,000 people. A century later, 250 were still alive. The Kapiri people had consisted of 25,000. A century later, less than 1,000 were still alive. The Massachusetts people had been with 88,000 people. A century later, there were less than 2,000. And that was before a renewed outbreak of smallpox in the beginning of the 18th century killed even more people. By 1750, the native population of New England had fallen to only a few dozen. And of course, it did not end there. George Washington instructed Major General George Sullivan to destroy the Iroquois, who had after all treacherously collaborated with the British during the Revolutionary War. Quote, lay waste all settlements. The country must not merely be overrun, but it must be destroyed. Do not listen to any overture of peace until the entire country is destroyed. And Sullivan complied with Washington's orders and turned the entire region from a garden to a scene of dreary desolation. And he spared nobody until the last Iroquois was hunted down and killed. Something Washington completely proved with. After all, he wrote, Indians were just like wolves, beasts of prey, though different in shape. They had to be removed, in order that they vexed the settlers no longer. When the father of American anthropology, Lewis Henry Morgan, did his research on the Iroquois in the 1850s, almost all Iroquois people had vanished, and of one of the main people of the League, the Seneca, merely a few hundred remained. They were crammed into a small reservation that, if that was by itself not sufficient, was held by a couple of land speculators, the Ogden Company, who hunted them down, Morgan wrote, with a degree of wickedness unparalleled in human history. It is no small crime, Morgan exclaimed, to seize firesides and property of a whole community against their will, and then drive them beggared and outraged into a wilderness. And that was exactly the scheme the Ogden Company continued to pursue. However, some listeners might now say, all this was indeed unparalleled until the 2008 banking crisis, when tens of thousands of people were similarly evicted and driven into the wilderness. Of course, since the Iroquois had to be taught the meaning of civilization and of capitalism. And thus, this was to be only the beginning. In the 19th century, the Europeans evicted, dispossessed, the inhabitants of a quarter of the globe. No longer merely in the USA, but in Canada, in Australia, in the Pacific, in the South American Pampas, in South Africa or in the Amazonas. But the process is actually still ongoing. I shall deal with this in a later lecture. In the next three lectures, though, I will shift from economics and politics to culture and to religion.